This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
How come a couple of cats from Harlem come downtown this morning looking for John Shaft?
Well, they're soul brothers. They came down so I could teach them to handshake.
They find you?
Of course. I wasn't hiding.
If you find out anything, give me a call, huh? I'm still at the 38th precinct.
Right on.
Hey, where the hell are you going, Shaft?
To get laid. Where the hell are you going?
A scene from the 1971 film Shaft, the first of the blaxploitation films. In the 70s, many African Americans criticized these black action films for glamorizing drugs, violence, and sex. But now they're celebrated by many young African American filmmakers for creating black screen heroes and opening up Hollywood's doors to black actors and directors. The Film Forum in New York is in the middle of a blaxploitation festival featuring such films as Shaft, Superfly, Coffee, and Cleopatra Jones. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear some of the creators of now classic black action films. The movie that inspired the blaxploitation era was the 1971 independent film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. It was shot on a budget of $500,000 and ended up grossing $10 million. Melvin Van Peebles produced, wrote, directed, and starred in the film. The story was about a black revolutionary on the run after he kills two white cops who brutalized a fellow revolutionary. Melvin is now also known as the father of actor and director Mario Van Peebles. They collaborated on this year's film Panthers about the Black Panthers. I spoke with Melvin Van Peebles in 1990.
Your film, Sweetback, was considered to be the first of the blaxploitation films. What you did was you took the action genre and put it into a black politicized context. And I'd really be interested in hearing what gave you the idea to do that.
My original reason for going into films was that I had gotten tired of seeing blacks portrayed in an image that I didn't agree with. So I wanted to control how I was perceived, and therefore I went into films. Now, you said something very interesting when you said that the film was the first blaxploitation film. It was not really the blaxploitation film. It started blaxploitation, which took out the political content and just kept the action and the winning black person. In fact, the revolutionary aspect of Sweetback was put at a 180-degree turn and became almost an apology for the man. For example, what I mean by that is Sweetback had a political education, this person who was essentially apolitical, as he was running from a situation that he always had avoided, he discovered that all of the lines in the community were controlled by a larger power structure, and that power structure was coming down on him like a ton of bricks. And therefore, what he had avoided, that knowledge that he had avoided, he was confronted with. And rather than acquiesce to that situation, he charged forward. However, what they did afterwards is they took someone like the detectives, who, if you really analyze it very carefully, was always under the thumb of an urban buona. That is, Shaft had the commissioner to report to, even though he was permitted to be a slightly freelance, slightly freewheeling, which was the sop that was thrown to the black audience. The Cleopatra Jones series. There, again, you had someone who was working for the government as an undercover agent. In each case, these people became an apology for the system.
You're talking about wanting to make movies that had an image that you believed in. Now, Sweetback was praised by a lot of people for really for being a black film, you know, made by blacks, starring blacks, set in the black community. On the other hand, it was criticized by many people within the black community for having its hero be the real stud. And some people saw that as perpetuating a stereotype instead of shattering it. And I wonder what you thought of those criticisms and what you think of them now in retrospect.
Well, I thought that Jesus Christ was nothing but a carpenter in his own hometown, and so it really didn't bother me too much. I think that's completely valid, what they said, and I disagree with it 100%. That is, you can take a stereotype, and you don't have to run from it. You can take it to the other side and throw it back a la karate, or I'm sorry, a la jiu-jitsu, and use that stereotype as the impetus for your force. You see, I could have taken Sweetback and had him a college professor, but that was not the situation of the people that I wanted to talk to, the larger group of people that I wanted to talk to. I took Sweetback from, let's say, one of the lowest possible common denominators in the community and therefore moved him forward. I didn't move him forward from some elevated period or position in the community from the first place, whereas the people once again left out in the cold. It wasn't somebody that they knew. That's why I felt that the audience reacted so positively, the major audience, much of the intelligentsia or many of the cultural nationalists did not like that move. Well, that is a valid point of view. It doesn't happen to be my own.
There were a couple of weeks when Sweetback outdid Love Story at the box office, which is pretty extraordinary considering it was an independently produced film. How did you independently get that kind of distribution?
Well, I didn't independently get that kind of distribution. What I simply did was make a good movie. Only two theaters in the United States would show it. Two theaters at all would show the movie. And they did so well, then everybody called me. And at that stage of the game, hey, it was their turn in the barrel. I made deals, and the audience went to see it. That's how that happened.
Director Melvin Van Peebles recorded in 1990. The first of the studio blaxploitation films was Shaft, starring Richard Roundtree as a private eye looking for the kidnapped daughter of a Harlem ganglord. The theme from Shaft launched a new sound in action themes and won a 1972 Academy Award for the composer and singer Isaac Hayes. He went on to star in a couple of action films. In the 60s, Isaac Hayes helped shape the sound of Memphis soul music as a songwriter, arranger, producer, and singer for Stax Records. He co-wrote hits for Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Johnny Taylor. I spoke with Isaac Hayes last year.
Now, you recorded the theme for the movie Shaft in, I guess it was 1971. How were you asked to do this?
Well, it was a whole concept. Hollywood recognized that they had to look further than they had been looking to get business. I think it was fledgling at the time. It was a bit stagnant. And Melvin Van Peebles had put out a movie called Sweetback's Badass Song. And they said, it might be a market there. If we come up with a concept to have a leading black leading man, a black director, maybe a black composer, we might hit that market. MGM was the one that pioneered the idea. So we had a meeting out there at MGM with Stax execs, and they asked me to come. And they talked about the concept. And would I do the music? Would I be interested in doing the music? Yeah. I said, I want to act too, man. Have y'all cast for the lead role? Well, I don't know. We'll look into that. But anyway, I think that was a sticking carrot, you know. So, right. So I agreed to do the music. They had already cast Richard Roundtree, which was rightfully so. He's perfect for the part. And I agreed to do the music. And that's how that whole thing, that whole idea came about.
Here's where you really get into orchestrating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you started using that wah-wah guitar funk style.
Well, okay, trade secrets. Now, when it was time for me to do the Shaft theme, I said, now, what can I do? They explained the character to me, you know, a relentless character, always on the move, always on the prowl, and you got to get something to denote that for the main theme. I said, now, what can I do? I thought about If you remember Otis Redding's Trial of the Tenderness, I had a hand in that arrangement too. In the end, Al Jackson was doing some stuff on a hi-hat cymbal. You know, you got the na-na-na, boom, you know. So I thought about that. I said, maybe if I just sustain that particular thing on the hi-hat, that would give you a dramatic effect as something that's relentless. Now, what else can I do? I thought about the guitar lick, and I went and pulled it out, played it, and Charles Pitts, we call him Skip, he played the thing on the wah-wah. I said, hey, play this line. He started it. And I told Willie, the drummer, I said, Willie Hall, I said, give me that hi-hat, man, some 16 notes, you know. And he did that, and it worked.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right.
Now, there's something I've been hoping to be able to play for you for a long time, and I'm just thrilled I have the opportunity to do it now. I want to play this record for you, and tell me, I figure you've probably heard it, and you could tell me what you think of it. So let's hear an excerpt, and then we'll talk about it.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on. Black private eye, whose mastermind has got him what he wanted. Shaft. Shaft is the man.
Isaac Hayes, you recognize the recording?
Yeah. I produced that on Sammy Davis.
Did you really? You produced it. Yeah. That's Sammy Davis. Yeah. No, what did you think of Sammy Davis doing Shaft?
Well, I mean, I was thrilled. You know, I mean, you know, Sam and I were friends, and he wanted to do it. You know, and in fact, the night that we were in the studio doing that, it was the Golden Globe Awards. And I had no idea I would win, so Lou Gossett received the award in my stead. And I was in the studio with Sammy. Oh, wow.
It just seemed, you know, it's just really funny to, it's so out of character for him. I mean, he was going through this real kind of groovy period, I guess.
Yeah. You know Sammy, you know, he was into what was happening now, which is good. You know, he rolled with the trends.
Isaac Hayes recorded last year. We'll hear from action star Pam Grier after a break. This is Fresh Air. The queen of the blaxploitation films was Pam Grier. She was a sexy, tough-talking, two-fisted, sharp-shooting avenger doing battle with pushers and pimps. Grier was an action hero years before women action heroes were common in mainstream films.
She's bad, she's beautiful, and she's back. She's Pam Grier, and when a woman's this hot, you can never get enough.
How about that?
Next is Coffee, a young nurse who's seen her 11-year-old sister destroyed by drugs. Now she wants to find out who's responsible and pay them all back. She turns into a one-woman hit squad on a trail of vengeance lined with hitmen, prostitutes, and thugs. It's Pam Grier in an explosive story of action, danger, and retribution.
All your friends are dead. Why kill them all?
Coffee. Then meet Friday Foster, ace photographer for Glance magazine.
She's just all woman.
Who becomes entangled in a web of political intrigue that takes her from the streets of New York to the corridors of power.
I want to talk with you about some of the blaxploitation films that you were in the beginning of your career. I know when I interviewed the filmmakers Robert Townsend and Keenan Ivory Wayans, they both said that that those black action films were really important to them because it was the first time where there was a black hero and he got to get the girl at the end. He wasn't just the asexual sidekick. And I was wondering if you felt you had an equivalent effect for women watching the movies.
Oh, absolutely. Not only was it our images in front of the camera, we had craftsmen and technicians who got in the unions, which are now, which was very difficult to do, and now there are people who are within the business who can, you know, form production companies of their own and who've learned how to do films. So all around it was very important on the technical side and the artistic side. For me, The films that I did, Coffee, Foxy Brown, and Sheba, were based on the women, the female characters in my family, who weren't very physical, but yet they were very strong women, but yet trying to maintain a sense of femininity. And my characters were based on my aunt, my mom, my grandmother, and some of the other women that lived in the neighborhood, that if, you know, they would protect their children with, you know, physical violence if they had to. And I guess for any woman, I think any woman would, whether she's strong or not.
Of course, they didn't go around shooting men in the groin like your characters
No, but I
did.
Bet you they would if someone tried to attack them. I know where their knee would go if someone would try to steal their purse or hurt one of their children. I know exactly where their knee would go, or a broom or a brick or a skillet.
I think your first film was Black Mama, White Mama. Describe the part you played in that.
Well, it was a takeoff of a film that was done with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis, Terry, called The Defiant Ones, right? And, what was it? Yeah,
yeah, The
Defiant Ones.
Where they're handcuffed together,
right,
they're both
so
prisoners?
So all of a sudden they did a female version of us escaping from a prison, defiantly trying to survive. So I guess, and it had a different title, Chains of Hate. Right, Chains of Hate. And they changed it to Black Mama, White Mama. You know, I'm sure that was to pull in the box office. And it was about two women escape from prison, chained together, and how they help each other. And my co-star, Margaret Markoff, was a ballerina.
Now, there became in your movies, I think, scenes you almost had to do in the films. I think it must have gotten to the point where you almost had to have a scene where you had a long, drawn-out series of fistfights with other women.
Yeah, I think that was some subtle, I don't know what you would call it on the air. I'm trying to find a better word for it. I don't know if it was on the part of the filmmaker or that they really like to see women be physical or do physical things or fight each other. I remember there were a lot of movies in the 50s where people really were excited to see women, you know, roll around the floor and fight. And I used to see it in my neighborhood, and I didn't like it. It used to bother me, you know, and it still bothers me. It's amazing because I have this strange contradiction. I have an aversion to violence, and I often look like Mary Poppins the way I dress, and I have that mentality. And then while I'll do a film, and it's the antithesis of how I really feel. I think the way I do a film, I see it, and it's something that my mother and my grandparents used to say to me, before you cast stones, walk a mile in someone's shoes. So I think the roles that I play are, I try to play someone who has that rage and violence and try to do it well. And I don't think it's something that I just want to do in my career from film after film, or that I had to do. I think I was the only one that was really good at it and made it look convincing.
Let me get back to some of your films from the 70s. We were talking about how there was a fight with women in several of the films. Mm. There was also castration scenes where you'd shoot somebody or have another way.
Must have been a metaphor.
How did these end up being an almost trademark in your film?
Well, I think it wasn't to be taken seriously. The scenes in the films weren't to be taken seriously. The castration was for people to. I think it was like a modern monster movie where you would see something so horrific and people would like, yeah, get them. That's what the bad guy deserves. He was such a bad guy, and people who have different imaginations will see different things from it. And I think the only castration scene possibly was in this movie, Foxy Brown had one. And it was basically tongue-in-cheek and a bunch of metaphors, I never took it seriously.
Another thing is that in so many of your scenes, your clothes were draped in such a way, and you were positioned in such a way as to be the sexiest. So tell me what it was like when they would be positioning you so that you'd be showing off, you know, more cleavage or whatever.
You can't really hide my cleavage. It's just there, unfortunately. I was one of those well-endowed children. And I think you know, all of that was exploited to sell tickets on behalf of the filmmakers.
Did that bother you, or did you just get into it because you knew that there was a certain camp value in this
also? No, it was camp, but it was also an age where nudity in the 70s, we were still riding that wave of, you know, that free love and romping around Woodstock naked and our bodies are beautiful and why should I be ashamed of my body and that. And black women were never appreciated as that woman on the podium. She wasn't in advertising as much. She wasn't considered as beautiful. And black men didn't have these, you know, these black female sexy images to also feel good about their manhood. And I think that was an accumulation of why, you know, I draped and I was sultry and smoky and all those adjectives that they described me as.
Pam Grier recorded in 1990. Her film Coffee is being shown this weekend at the Film Forum in New York as part of their series Blaxploitation, Baby.